Welcome to Threshold Stories, crossing thresholds one story at a time. I'm your host, Jeff Gora. Hello, everybody. This is podcast 114, working with refugees, part two. 115 will be all about the world championships. I'm going to continue with the theme of the refugees since there was a lot to say and much to share. So last time I talked almost exclusively about the experiences we had with our first group, which was the Ukrainian water polo team, the 12-year-old boys, and that's a video you can watch anytime. Today I want to talk about working with the refugees in the hotel, because that one took more time and it had more people involved with it. So to recap a bit, in the town of TM, in Turgu Mureş, there was a hotel near the center of town that was owned by the city that had been handed over for use by the refugees. And the guy who kind of drove that process, or at least introduced himself to us as the guy who drove this process, his nickname is Cookie, and this is his picture right here. Cookie works at the local university. I thought he was an instructor or something like that, since he seemed well-connected with the youth, but he's not. He works in the marketing department. And he had relationships with a Ukrainian university, and he invited people to come from Ukraine to Romania after the war started. And he worked with the leadership at the local university to try to get the right kinds of letters out the door with the right letterhead, and he ended up interacting with city officials as well. And he was able to find this specific hotel. So the hotel had been unused, but it was a beautiful hotel. And he was able to get the city to hand over the hotel for use by the refugees. But because it was a hotel per se, it had some limitations. So it wasn't designed for three square meals day in and day out. And there was this issues associated with feeding the refugees as a direct result. So let's talk a little bit about working with the refugees here. So here's a picture of Cookie standing in what used to be the discotheque of the hotel. And you can see from the lights and the chandeliers and the step up, it was, you know, a place where you would dance. Well, now it's become a food bank. So apparently there were 37 families, that's my understanding, staying in this specific hotel. And it was getting tenuous to take care of them because they'd now been there over 100 days. The original person we spoke with from the previous slide, Christian, our driver, told us that the community was quick to reach out and help the refugees once they arrived. And people were taking turns doing things like food preparation, serving them with whatever they needed at the time. But people were getting really fatigued. So one of the responses of the community was, let's let them cook and let's give them stuff to cook so they can do it the way they would like to. So here's a picture of the kitchen. So you can see from the picture that there's a table in the middle, some sinks, some stoves, and that's it. So everybody had to share that at or around dinner time. And what they had to cook there was either stuff they bought themselves, which they did some. I mean, some of them had cash coming in from home, but they were more likely than not looking for donations from the food bank itself. So when we met Cookie the very first day and he was taking us around places, one of the things he wanted to do which would go food shopping. So I shared with him a concern that I had, which literally every person on this should have. And that concern comes with an answer to the question, how do I know that the money I donate is actually going for the cause, right? The short of it is you don't, but there are mechanisms that you can put in place, simplistic accountability, to make it such that it does happen. It's commonplace among ministries globally to get this really wrong. We hear of a need, it's too far away, we don't know anybody, we don't speak the language. So we just ship over money and decide that it's our job to respond and it's God's job or somebody else's job for there to be accountability and the money to be used. And we choose to take a path of feeling no guilt, no shame if the money gets misappropriated because we did our job. Well, that sort of short-sighted thinking is thousands of years old and incorrect because it never builds a sense of trust when you think like that. So one of the things I told Cookie is I need to be able to look people in the eye after they've made their donations and tell them where the money went, not tell them where I think it went, tell them where it went. So I took, over the course of a couple of days, a couple of different visits to go shopping. So here is a picture of us at a grocery store. So you can see the grocery store looks rather nice. It looks like one you would find anywhere in Western Europe or United States or Canada, whatever. This was kind of the equivalent of Sam's Club since they had a lot of bulk things in the store. And we made a decision that we would go use Cookie's list, and Cookie would come with us. And we would buy whatever's on the list and bring it back and leave it there. And then I kept all of the receipts for all the shopping we did. So as you can see from the piles that we've accumulated here from shopping, the grocery stores are nice, and we were filling multiple buggies each time we went. So Carolyn, the girl in this picture on the left in the white shirt, she was very motivated to help out and make a difference. She is smart. She's a great athlete. In fact, she won the silver medal at this event. She connects with people really well. She's got a lot of social presence, but she does have a heart to help. Throwing money at a situation, she fundamentally gets that that may help, but it also might not help. But doing this activity totally lit her up. She thought this was a great idea. She was very helpful. She posted on her social channels the activities that she played a role in, and she was more than willing to help. One time when we went, we filled four shopping carts amongst us. So here's a picture of one of the shopping carts, which was just filled with nothing but chicken. With that many families, Cookie told us that there were four freezers in the former discotheque that they could use for meat storage, cold storage, whatever the case may be. So Cookie made sure that we used the money that we brought over to buy those more expensive things, since meat's considered a more expensive thing, and try to fill up those freezers as much as we can, because canned goods and things like that are relatively cheap and easy to store, but actually purchasing meat and getting it home and storing it without it going bad of the volumes we were looking at buying meant we needed a couple of cars to do it. So my friend Ed Marks and his wife Cimarron went shopping with us, and they had a rental car. So we took the time to fill up the cars as best as we could with food. So here's a picture of Ed and Cimarron at a Lidl store. Yes, they have Lidl's in Romania. And we're filling the back of that one with meats and water. Carolyn's standing next to Jordan there with some additional food. And in this car, in this picture, that's a picture of Cookie with Connor, who he'd already raced one race, and he was wearing the shirt from it, where we'd filled the back of Cookie's car with nothing but pork meat. And there was, of course, lots of other things there. But this just gives you an idea of the volume of food we purchased for the refugee center. When we took the food back to the refugee center, we had to unload everything and carry it down the stairs and deposit it in the kitchen as best as we could. And when we did that, there was already a couple of Ukrainian women in the kitchen preparing food. Now, I don't know what they were preparing. I tried to engage them in conversation, but they didn't speak any English back to me. Later, somebody told me that they spoke perfect English, but they just didn't want to engage me in the process. So we made sure that they had food as much as we can. One of the things that I feel like I put as part of the podcast is I just thought I would show these pile of receipts from all the different grocery store visits we had. Almost 500 pounds of potatoes, 20 kilos of pork, 33 kilos of chicken. So you can do the math on how much that equates to. We had one list receipt. It was this big. We just bought toiletries. I think Carolyn probably spent 2 minutes just putting soap and shampoos in a buggy, just nonstop. Pick it up, pick it up. They scan it. They put it on the counter. She would throw it in the buggy because of the volume that we needed. Cookie wanted to make sure that everybody there had ample hygiene products, and he didn't want to give people, you know, one family size container of shampoo. Considering that one person might hog it all and the 37 other families might have nothing. So he bought a lot of individually sized things. As kind of a statement to the credibility of the human race, I met with a guy named David Pearson, who was the manager of Team Great Britain. And he got wind of what we were doing, partly from me, but he saw the t-shirts that others were wearing, and he saw the refugees in our group. And he said he would send a message out to all the Team GB athletes to see if any of them want to participate. And there was one person from Team GB who agreed to meet us at the refugee camp and ride with us to the grocery store. And he didn't say anything about what he thought he might do. But when we got to the checkout line, he pulled out his credit card and he says, "I'm just going to pay for one of these baskets." And so he took his credit card out. It was a business card, so he didn't need a receipt because he was the owner of the business. And he just swiped the card and paid for one out of the four carts worth of food. And went back with us and unloaded and walked away and said, thank you very kindly for letting me help. That kind of spirit is the kind of spirit that has existed, I think, since the dawn of humanity. Somebody was hurting. There was very little way he was going to create a system or participate in something that he made from scratch and make a difference. So he just jumped in with us. Well, truth be told, some people gave me a lot of credit for organizing this refugee movement. Cookie had already sorted through what was needed and what the procedure needed to be, and we just helped with that. So he took ownership of working with the locals to get the food bank set up and the clothing bank set up. So we just brought everything into the facility that he already had, and the refugees kept using what they were already using. The last thing they needed was another system to be dumped upon them by an outsider and say, this is what you need to do. On a parallel sort of note, one mistake a lot of organizations place out there when they're trying to work with refugees in a sustained environment like this is they think that the right thing to do is to bring everything over to the refugees. Well, that's no good. If I had showed up with $5,000 worth of food instead of buying $5,000 worth of food, that meant that some grocery store would not be able to sell $5,000 worth of food to the people who are eating in the community, which means all of a sudden they go through a lull in sales that perhaps they weren't expecting. Now I show up and they get a burst in sales. And truth be told, I was getting great food, fresh food, at a substantially cheaper price than I'd ever buy it here in the States. And I was able to make that dollar go an awful lot farther, as well as stimulate the local economy. here's a video of an unloading event that I feel somewhat important. One of the things Cookie told me that he had already organized was a bunch of donations from an organization in Italy, and the organization was more than willing to give him everything. But when they saw the cost of transportation from Italy to TM, they said, Cookie, you're going to have to raise the money to pay for this. And I asked him, how much is it? And he said, about 1,000 euros. And so I said, okay, if I pay for this, I'm sort of taking a risk that it's going to happen. Would you agree to shoot some videos of the unloading of all these goods? And here's another video of the unloading.
Day.
So everybody back home can see that the money I gave actually went for what it intended to. So sure enough, it did. So he ends up being a respectable person on that front. On a final note, I still have a little bit over $600, $620 in my personal checking account that I've fundraised through GoFundMe that still needs to go to the Ukrainians. And so just a few days ago, I asked Cookie in a message, I have another $600 or so. What would you like me to do with it? And his answer was, I don't want it right now. Just sit on it, and I'll tell you when I have a need. Right now, it's all good. And that's the second time I've heard that. You know, the water polo team had a similar response saying, we don't need that money right now. Sit on it or give it to somebody who truly needs it. So let me jump to the story now of Amelia. So here's a little video of Amelia introducing herself to us. And I just caught this on video. What is your name?
My name is Amelia.
So how did you meet us today?
Cookie called me and asked to help.
And what did you think you were going to do today?
My role was just to help to communicate with kids.
Did you think you were going to teach them a new game?
No.
Did you like the game?
Yes, I did.
Thank you very much. So as you can see, Amelia is really photogenic. She was a young girl. She was intelligent. She wanted to go to law school. And later she told us that she wanted to go to school in Italy, but she didn't think she'd be able to go. Well, I didn't know what that meant, but I decided to translate it as it was probably going to be too expensive for a Romanian girl to just get up and go to school in Italy. So when we finished the event, one of the things I always do for people is I pray for them. So I asked the water polo guys if we could pray for them, and they agreed, and we all did. And I asked Amelia, because she'd been translating for us on and off for an hour or two, I said, can we pray for you? And she said, of course. And when I put my hands on her, I kind of knew immediately what to do. We finished praying and we walked outside. I didn't want to embarrass her inside, but we walked outside. I decided to embarrass. I said, Amelia, let us help you fulfill your dream. We're here. We have cash. It was intended for the water polo kids. They said they don't want it. Let us change your life. And she looks at Cookie and begins to cry and says, Cookie, like asking him to intervene. And he wouldn't. He just kind of shook his head throughout the whole process. And I could tell at that point that she was sort of, she was in reverence to Cookie. Cookie was not her boss, but she was submitting to Cookie's guidance. He was her leader in the moment. So I had asked all the Team USA people who were outside with us, I said, how much money do you guys got? Because I didn't bring much money with me to visit the refugee camp. I had maybe, I'm going to make a number up, $500. Maybe it was $300. Because my expectation was to come back again later and go shopping with them. So everybody gave me what they had. Aaron, I don't remember the exact dollar amount, but she gave me literally everything she had, including a couple of $1 bills. Mindy sounded the same way. Mindy gave me what she had, but she wasn't carrying a lot of cash. Kimmy, on the other hand, had a boatload of cash. And she gave me $500 in cash. And when we combined all that, we had about $1,000. And you can multiply that and you can determine it goes a long way over there. And so I tried to hand that money to Amelia, and she wouldn't take it. She was resisting it. And this is kind of where Kimmy stepped in and did something that I'm certainly never going to forget for the rest of my life. Kimmy took the money from my hand and stuffed it down Amelia's bra, knowing good and well that no man would do that. But also knowing good and well that no woman's going to reach in there and take it out and hand it back either. Kimmy had the insight to know to do that. And at that point, everybody kind of got touched because we realized that there was this event occurring. So I'm going to fast forward 2 days. So 2 days later, I'm sitting outside of a small Turkish outdoor restaurant with Jordan, a guy from he's been in the pictures in both times. And Amelia walks by and I flag her down. And she sits down with us for a second or so. We'd already since connected on Facebook. And she was watching a lot of the posts I was doing. And I asked her, so what's next? You're about to finish this semester here in TM at the university here. What's next? And she kind of, you know, gazes down for a second in a statement of delight and humility all at the same time. Said, I've talked with my mother and I'm going to school in Italy in 2 weeks. It's like, yes, that's why we do these things. That's why we do these things. And I consider that, you know, a big part of the success. So some questions that I've been asked, let me go forward here and answer a couple of questions that I've been asked. The first one that I think came up a lot from other people who've been watching me deal with the refugees, because I was talking with them on the phone. I have several of them I'm communicating with in WhatsApp now. First question I get is, am I going back to Romania? And I said, right now my answer is no. It's hard to get there. There are no more events there. There's a language barrier, and I feel like what I was asked to do in time, I was able to do, and I supported an engine that was already running. The next question that comes up, are you going to continue to support them? And my answer is, to the extent that I can, yes, but probably more than that, I'm going to probably maintain some relationships there. So let's fast forward here a bit and pull some anonymity into the conversation. I know many people who go on missions trips to other places. I know a woman who's been going to Honduras repeatedly, friends who go to West Virginia, whatever the case may be. And there's a certain distance they keep between themselves and the people they're serving. Some of the times it's geographic, but in some instances they don't let them invade their social media accounts, for example. Well, if you know me, you know, you've probably noticed that anytime I post something, probably 20% of the people who reply are doing so in another language, because in Nepal, where much of my ministry has been throughout my whole life, written English is not commonplace. There, most people use English characters to write sentences in Nepali, so it's not really legible. Or they're actually using the Nepali script, you know, which looks like a can of earthworms that's been dumped upside down in the eyes of many people. So as part of being a Peace Corps volunteer, you really cannot put your hand up and push people away when you've just tried to pull them in to help them. If you do that, you're kind of, well, not kind of, you are a hypocrite in a certain sense. So I imagine, because I have been reached out to and friended by several people from Romania, I'm going to continue to have at least online relationships with a lot of people in Romania. So Amelia's probably listening to this. I imagine I will continue to support her efforts to become a law school student, a lawyer, indefinitely, as long as people continue to give. People were very interested in the Amelia story face-to-face when I was telling it to people. And I got some donations just telling that story, saying, here, use this for Amelia's education. So I have a stash of money. I have $400 right now sitting there that people have given me that I've set aside just for Amelia's education as well. The other question was, what about the water polo team? So there was a woman on Team USA who had a son who worked with water polo in the United States, and my intention was to connect the two of them together. So far, that hasn't happened. I've done my share of reaching out. I haven't heard anything back. I've messaged the person that she said I should talk to, which happens to be her son, but I still haven't heard anything. From what I can tell, the water polo kids are wealthy and relatively cared for and stable, and they have a system that really works for them. So they're not on my concern list as much as some of the people who are inside of the hotel. All right, so a high-quality story here to end things. One of my, I got two Ukrainian Bibles given to me, and each one contained a letter that had been typed out, and it was both in English and in Ukrainian from Mike Kachuk. So Mike's family heritage is Ukrainian. His wife had already come over to the house and donated a lot of supplies, which I took over, lightly worn clothing that I took with me to Romania. And he gave me these two Bibles, and when he gave them to me, he gave me a very short summary, much longer than the letter. He said, these were my grandfather's Bibles. I got them when he died in 2016. And I'm putting words in his mouth. This isn't what he said, but this is what I heard. He said, there's no value to these books if all they do is sit on my shelf and nobody reads them. So I'm giving them to you to go find somebody who can read them. And it was basically, well, he didn't say basically. He says, this is the last of what I have from my grandfather's passing. And he wasn't shaking when he gave them to me, but you could tell he was about to. And so I knew that I needed to be very thoughtful and concerned and whatever else you want to call it with those two Bibles. So here's a picture of one of them. You might recognize her from the previous podcast. This was the woman who stood next to me in... at the Parade of Nations. She was from Odessa. She jumped in her car and took off as soon as her husband said go. And so she went, and her child was in the front of the parade with me. And I asked her when we were in line, because her English was, you know, okay. I said, do you know what this is? And I showed her a picture, front cover of the Bible. And she said, of course. And I said, do you have one? And she says, no, when we were packing to leave, I didn't bring one of those. And I said, well, would you like one? And she said, of course I would like one. Yes, please, please. And I said, okay, I'm going to get you one, and Cookie will give it to you after I've left, because I didn't have them with me. We were ready to start the Parade of Nations. It didn't seem like it made sense. And so this is her with one of Mike's Bibles. That was inside of it. It said it was published in 1962. So that was a 60-year-old book she was holding. Here is the other one he gave me, and Cookie decided to give it to this woman. I don't have any intel on who she is or why he chose her, but he knew my heart. We had talked about it, and I'm sure he screened her and gave it to her, counting on it going to good use. She's what you just call in Russian a babushka, so she was like everybody's grandmother. And so she now has one of the recipients of Mike's Bible. If anybody wants to get the letter, reach out to me, and if I have permission from Mike, I'll be more than willing to share the letter with you. So I'm leaving the GoFundMe open for people who still want to contribute, because I know Cookie's going to have ongoing needs to go grocery shopping, and I know he's good for it. I'm also going to leave it open if anybody wants to contribute to Amelia's education in Italy, because based on how much things cost over there, I'm sure she's very smart with her money. And I'm going to continue to support her as long as I can, and I will continue to keep the receipts as much as I possibly can. Thanks for listening. Enjoy. Thanks for listening to this chapter of Threshold Stories, Crossing Thresholds, One Story at a Time. You ready to cross more thresholds with me in 2 weeks? If you have any questions, feel free to reach out to me directly. You can find me on LinkedIn or on my Facebook page at Jeff Gora Team USA.